Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? It's Eddie Trunk, and welcome to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. You know the deal. It's new every Thursday. Thank you for subscribing and checking it out. Much appreciated, and hope you are having a great week so far. Well, what a podcast we have for you this week. I mean, we are always, I'm always bringing you some unbelievable interviews and guests, but it's a rare time, it's a rare podcast when you can say the guests are two of the founding members of Black Sabbath. Just nuts to even say that. But that's what I have for you this week. Two separate interviews, one with Tony Iommi, one with Geezer Butler. And next week, I'll give you the two drummers that played in Black Sabbath, the two of note, another founding member of the band, Bill Ward, and Vinny Appice. Back-to-back in next week's podcast. These are gargantuan interviews coming to you right here on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Now, let me explain the circumstances. Because as is usually the case, the interviews you hear or you are about to hear originated and aired live on my Sirius XM radio show, Trunk Nation, heard Monday through Friday on Volume, Sirius XM Channel 106, live 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern, nightly re-airs 10 to midnight Eastern. So as I always say, you're getting only a fraction of what's going on the radio show here on the podcast. If you're in the U.S. or Canada, please come join me every week on the radio, every day I should say on the radio, six live shows, as a matter of fact, a week that I do on Sirius XM. A few weeks ago, I did Black Sabbath Week, where each day of the week I had a different Sabbath member on. I had Vinny, I had Bill Ward, I had Geezer Butler, I had Tony Iommi. Each day a different guest and a different news-making interview. And much of it was about the fact that a few weeks ago, for the 40th and 41st anniversary of the Mob Rules in Heaven and Hell, special deluxe editions of those records were issued. So the push was really a lot about the Dio era because that's what the interviews were aligned to do, and that's what we talked a lot about. And then I actually decided at the last minute to reach out to Bill Ward to see if he would like to be a part of the week as well, because he did play on Heaven and Hell, and he agreed to do it. And again, I'll bring you that next week. So next week, the two drummers of Black Sabbath with Bill Ward and Vinny Appice in one podcast. This week, two founding members with Geezer and Tony. I'm so excited to now be able to present this to the world free as my podcast, and I really think you will enjoy these interviews. We will start with the guy who started it all, Tony Iommi, and follow it with Geezer. Some great stuff in the conversation with Tony. And with Geezer, some controversial stuff at the time. Both of these interviews, by the way, made huge news around the world when they aired live on my radio show. The controversy, if it was controversy, was what Geezer said in the interview about the origins of the Dio horns, you know, throwing the horns, as they say in metal, making that sign. And the backstory on that is that in the liner notes to the Heaven and Hell reissue, Geezer Butler tells a story about having done that sign in Sabbath long before Ronnie was in the band. And then when Ronnie joined the band, he didn't want to do the peace sign because that's what Ozzy did. So he did the horns bit, and Geezer claimed he gave him the idea. But everybody agrees that, of course, Ronnie ran with it and made it famous. Nobody would argue that. Geezer also mentions, and I think in the interview we say Paul McCartney, but in reality, John Lennon actually was the first person to be seen making that sign, like back in 1968 in the animation for Yellow Submarine. So, you know, there's always been debate, Gene Simmons, Dio, whoever. I've never heard anybody say John Lennon, but according to Geezer, he took it from Lennon. He was doing it in Sabbath as early as 71, and then he gave it to Dio, and Dio, being the front man, made it the famous sign it is today. But there was a lot of debate, discussion, dissension about what Geezer said. And again, it's in the liner notes to the new reissue of Heaven and Hell. So I did not, you know, I was just commenting and questioning about it from that. And Geezer said what he said. But he, you know, Geezer actually had put out, like, in the interview you're about to hear, this we'll do it second. Geezer actually put out like two or three statements after this interview aired live, clarifying things he said in it, which, you know, is his prerogative to do, but I think people, you know, took some stuff the wrong way or what have you, because it just made a lot of news in the media at the time. So anyway, Geezer Butler, you know, hysterical when I ask him about the reissues, as you're about to hear, because he's on the air to promote reissues that he knows nothing about. You know, it's just classic Geezer. And we'll start with Tony Iommi with great, great stuff in there from, look, the man who invented the genre we love. So I'm super excited to bring you the podcast this week. We'll start with Tony. We'll follow with Geezer. Again, it's not every day you can say, this week on the podcast, two of the founding members of Black Sabbath who invented heavy metal. That is coming up in seconds. It's a long one. You got a nice double dip this week with two legends with a capital L. Remember, follow me on Twitter at Eddie Trunk. Also Instagram at Eddie Trunk. Fan page on Facebook. Eddie Trunk is the official online home. Excited to let you guys know, for the first time in ages, I have appearances coming up. They're listed on the homepage of EddieTrunk.com. They include April 30th at Two Frogs in Ardmore, Oklahoma with Frank Hannon. And they also include May 1st and 2nd at the Dallas Guitar Festival in Dallas. More details and info as we get closer. Also got Houston coming up, North Dakota, a bunch of stuff. Things are happening again. It feels good. I got my vaccine. I'm ready to roll. And now shows are starting to trickle back a little bit, so everybody stay healthy out there, be well, and keep an eye out on my social media. Maybe I'm coming your way. It'll be great to reconnect with everybody and get back out there on the road again soon. We'll be right back. We'll get it started with the one and only Tony Iommi next on the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey, let me tell you about GovX. We have to always give great thanks to the police, firefighters, EMS, medical workers, all the folks on the front line, even military units. A lot of these folks deal with constrained budgets and outdated gear, but there's still a job to do. And of course, if you're in that field, you need the gear to do it. And you know, hunting for stuff for all of you folks and finding discounts has historically required going from one website to another. and creating multiple accounts or logins to make purchases and jumping through a lot of hoops to verify your service. I'm sure a lot of you, if you're in this field, wish there was just one place you could go to and visit that had a carefully crafted selection of deals for military first responders in one spot. And that place is GovX. GovX works directly with brands to negotiate the best prices possible because you deserve the gear you need at the prices you've earned. Plus, you can trust that the gear you're ordering is 100% authentic and direct from the manufacturer. They've got a huge collection of gear and apparel from popular brands all in one convenient location at the best price. And GovX honors your service and gives back to your communities. So, if you're an American of service, and we thank you for it, maybe a current or former member of the military, firefighters, frontline medical, law enforcement communities, or the emergency medical world, join GovX for free and enjoy a community that honors and gives back to patriots like you. If you've got a military or first responder background, all you got to do is visit govx.com, that's govx.com, and sign up for free for instant access to tons of deals and a community that honors your service. And be sure to use my code because you'll get $15 off your first order over $50 or more. And that code is TRUNK15, T-R-U-N-K, and the number 15, as in $15. TRUNK15, $15 off your first order of $50 or more. Use that code TRUNK15, govx.com.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Welcome back. As I mentioned, the two of the founding members of Black Sabbath, we start right now with Tony Iommi. Enjoy on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Tony, welcome. Thank you for the time. How are you?
Oh, thanks, Eddie. I'm fine. Thank you very much. Yeah.
You last we spoke, you know, we were in the middle of this thing with this pandemic, and now hopefully, at least here in the U.S., there's some signs of coming out the other side of it. How are things looking there for you in England?
Well, I mean, we're still in a complete lockdown here, and I think for another month. So it's a bit grim on that side. I mean, they're getting through all the shots, you know, injections and stuff pretty quick. But, you know, we still have to be locked down for a while yet, I think. So it's a bit, you're champing at the bit to start doing something else, really.
Have you gotten the shot, Tony? Are you going to get it?
Yes, I had mine, Eddie, about 5 weeks ago. And I
okay.
think the next one's due in probably, I think, seven weeks or something like that time.
Okay, good. So you're at least partially immunized. Yeah, I was lucky enough to get a first dose here, and I've got another one coming in a few weeks. It feels kind of good to at least have that. You know, at least for me, I'm sure you as well. It feels nice to have some protection and feeling like we're getting a step closer to normal again.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I can't wait to get back to some kind of normality.
Yeah. Hey, before I talk to you about what we're going to talk about today, which, of course, is the Dio era of Sabbath, predominantly these Heaven and Hell and the Mob Rules reissues, just before you join me on the air, I spent some time talking about Eddie Van Halen, and I know that you were extraordinarily close with him, and I was just wondering, I don't think we spoke since Eddie passed away. Any thoughts you'd like to share about your friendship and your history with Eddie, and did you have a chance to speak with him before he passed?
Well, we had a great long friendship, really, ever since, you know, they toured with us on the Never Say Die tour in 78. And so it was, you know, we'd stayed in touch. We lost contact for a while, then we got back in touch. And then it was great. We were in touch with each other on a regular basis. And when I'd be in L.A., his wife, and my wife and Eddie and myself would go out for dinner and get together. It was great. We had a really nice relationship, and he supported me a lot when I was ill. And you know, and I tried to support him as well. So we had a really good friendship, and I did actually was in touch with him not long before he went into hospital, just before he passed away, really.
Mm. And Tone, how are you doing with your health? Are you, where are you at with things? Are you on the other side of it at this point, or are you still managing it?
Well, I still manage it. I I had my checks 2 weeks ago, blood tests and all the rest of the stuff they do. And yeah, everything at the moment, Eddie, thank you, is going okay. I mean, I just get tired, really, but that's probably old age as well.
And also being locked up, you know, like you said, a year of lockdown and pandemic, you just want to get normal and move around and get out and be social, and that takes its toll too.
You do. And also, you know, one of the strange things I'm finding is you forget what to talk about because you're stuck in this bubble. And, you know, we can't actually, in England at the moment, you can't have anybody in your house except your own people you're living with, your own family. So, you know, you don't really get a chance to see anybody and actually have them in your house and talk to anybody. So you actually forget what to say and what to talk about, really. It's really peculiar. I think you all go a bit loony, really.
Are you somebody that spends a lot of time on Netflix?
I do. We've watched about everything, I think, now, Eddie. It's getting a bit too much now.
And so many musicians I talked to, Tony, during this past year or so have spent a lot of time writing or maybe going through their archives and chronicling things or going back on things. Have you done any of that? Have you worked on any music in the last year or so, whether it be new or maybe going through your vast catalog of riffs or anything like that that you've worked on?
Yes, I have played, I've done a couple of, I've done a project, I played on one of the tracks with Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. Mm. It was a charity record, and it's not out yet, I don't think. And they asked me to play on that, and that was interesting. That was something very different for me, because it was about, the guy that put it together was, the lyrics for the song were old war letters from the First World War, and people had died in the war, and they'd sent letters home, and of course they never came back, you know, and this guy got the letters, and it made them into lyrics, and it was quite an interesting project, really, and I quite enjoyed playing on that. But I've been doing stuff myself as well. I just put ideas down, but I'm not that good on working on computers and getting drums and all that sort of business. So I have to have my engineer. And of course, because of the pandemic, you can't have anybody in the house. So I can't have him here yet until, you know, a few weeks' time. But I have been trying to go through stuff, but you can only listen to so many things for a while. I've got so many riffs and CDs and that I start playing through, but you can only listen to them for so long. Then you have to have a break for a while. You start hearing things.
Well, obviously, one of the things that's come out, there's been a number of things in terms of Sabbath reissues, starting with the early Ozzy records. The recent Volume 4 reissue is fantastic. But today, what we're predominantly here to talk about is going back to that era that I loved so much and was when I first discovered Sabbath. And you and I have spent a lot of time, whether it be TV or radio interviews or even privately, talking about how magical and wonderful that era of Sabbath was, with Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules. And now we've got these two new reissues, which have just come out. And earlier this week, I had Vinny on yesterday. I had Geezer on Monday. Actually, I heard from Bill Ward, and he's going to come on tomorrow. So everyone's going to come on and talk about, you know, this particular period of Sabbath. And for you, Tony, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, having talked to Geezer and talked to Vinny, it's a really interesting thing that I've come up with in my head here, because here you are with the start of a new era of Sabbath. You've got Ronnie coming in as a singer, but you lost Bill in the middle of the tour, where he left and he was having well-documented problems at the time. And then Geezer, when he was on Monday, said that he had actually left and came back just in time to record the bass. So this triumphant, incredible record, if things didn't line up, you could have found yourself in a position where you could have really lost everybody at one point, couldn't you?
Well, it did. It went, you know, after Ozzy, it went, and then Ronnie came in, and then Geezer had to leave for his personal problems. And we were really stumped, and Ronnie, fortunately, could play bass. You know, he was playing bass on some of the, when we were rehearsing, putting stuff together. So we had a little setup in the house in that we rented a house in Beverly Hills, and we had a little, so I had a small amp, and then Bill had a small drum kit, and Ronnie just sort of sing through a little amp, you know, and it was very, very primitive, but it worked, you know, and we just had a tape record, just a cassette player, and we started putting the ideas together, you know, and Ronnie would play bass.
Did you have a contingency plan in mind if Geezer did not come back? Because when I spoke to Geez on Monday, he was saying he wasn't sure if he was going to be able to return. He wasn't sure what was going to happen, if he'd be able to come back to the band. And he said he got in pretty much just under the wire to be able to record the bass on the record. Were you planning, did you have somebody in mind if that didn't happen?
Well, we tried a few bass players, but I, you know, after playing with Geese so much, I mean, he's such a great player, and, you know, we knew each other so well, playing-wise as well, that, I really missed Geese when he went, and I was really hoping that he would come back at some point. When he left, obviously he had a reason, and you had to wait until he'd sorted himself out to come back. But we never knew for definite he was going to come back, no. So we had to look for other bass players. We tried different bass players. And Ronnie suggested Craig Gruber in the end, and we had him for a while. It was difficult. It was difficult because it was falling apart, but it was all getting together as well. It was really peculiar because with Ronnie's involvement, obviously we started, it was more of a positive attitude, and Ronnie came in, and I could work with Ronnie, and we could actually put something together.
Yeah, I guess my point on all this is it's really fascinating how close it came to you losing everybody, because if Geezer didn't come back in the 11th hour, and then, of course, Bill left right not long after the record was done, you would have been faced with the prospect of introducing Black Sabbath not only with a new singer, but an entirely new band at that point, which I know you actually did a version, you know, you did that going forward a little bit. But at that point, I think trying to resurrect the band, it would have made it threefold more difficult than just trying to tell people you had a new singer, that, you know, you had a fantastic new singer in Ronnie. So that was more of an easier sell. But trying to say, hey, you know, we've got a new bass player and a new drummer, that could have been, you know, changed the trajectory a lot, I would think.
Oh, and it was so difficult. I mean, you know, when Ronnie came in, it was great. He came in positive attitude, and we had this thing to fight for again. You know, let's we've got to prove ourselves, because we had everything against us at the time. Don Arden was managing us, and he didn't particularly want Ronnie in the band, and we wanted Ronnie in the band, and so obviously we parted company with him. And it made life really difficult. And of course, then when Geezer left, that was no. But you carry on. My attitude's always been, and you know me well enough now. I believe in what I do, and if somebody leaves, I mean, it's so easy to go, oh, that's it, then we'll break up. But I didn't want to break up. I wanted to carry on, and I felt we'd got something really positive, you know, when Ronnie came in, and it was a matter of believing in it and sticking with it, really. And fortunately, it all worked out in the end. Geezer came back, and we done the record. We done Heaven and Hell, and it was unfortunate. Yes, on the tour, Bill suddenly left at a show. He walked out on a show before the show. And that was difficult. I mean, because I'd known Bill for longer than anybody. Well, apart from Ozzy, of course. I mean, I was at school with Oz. But I played with Bill in two bands before Sabbath. So, you know, we were really locked in with each other. And so when Bill left, I was just devastated at that time and panicking. And Goose and myself were like, oh, no. But, you know, we were lucky to have Vinny come in.
Yeah, a bit. Vinny told that story yesterday on the air about coming in and the first show in Hawaii, and you were so concerned that he had such a small drum kit.
Oh, God. I gave him some stick. I mean, it was terrible, really, because, you know, after being used to playing with Bill for so many years, and I knew Bill inside out as far as playing-wise, we'd follow each other really well, and with Geese as well. And then when Vinny came in, it was like, I was panicking. We rehearsed, we only had a short rehearsal in Los Angeles, and then we had this show in Hawaii. And of course, Vinny wrote all his notes out and everything, and, you know, and he said, don't worry, it'll be okay, I'll have it. And the day of the show in Hawaii was a big open air festival, a big open air show, and I was pacing the room, panicking, and Ronnie kept saying, don't worry, everything's going to be all right. I go, no, it's not. It's going to be all right. Anyway, we got on stage, and I saw Vinny's kit, and I nearly passed out. He got this kit on Bill's drum riser, which was Bill's drum riser. It was a big drum riser because he had a big kit. And then Vinny had this little kit in comparison to Bill's. And I thought, oh, God, you're never going to be able to hear him. And of course, he had all his notes there, and it started raining, and his notes got smudged, and he had to sort of wing it. But I tell you, he'd done a great job, Vinny, and great player. And we got through it, and that was it. Then once we'd actually done a show, everything fell into place.
Two questions about Heaven and Hell, and then we'll talk a little bit about Mob Rules. I mean, I could talk to you about all this forever, but I know we don't have unlimited time. But what has come out also recently is that of all the songs on Heaven and Hell, the only one that was around in some form, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but that ended up on the record was an early version of Children of the Sea, and that was the only thing that Ozzy actually did a demo of. Do you have the demo? Do you have a version anywhere in your archives of Ozzy singing Children of the Sea?
Yes, I have. It's amongst some of my hundreds of CDs and cassettes I've got, you know. But yes, I do have. I have all the stuff, or most of the stuff from those times, yeah.
Wow, that would be amazing to hear.
Oh, well, you might do one day. The melody line Ozzy done on it was good. I mean, he done a good melody line and a good chorus. But again, it wasn't fully in place, Children of the Sea. We only had sort of half of it. but when Ronnie came in, I mean, you can't sort of say, Ronnie, here, this is the vocal, because Ronnie had his own ideas, and Ronnie was such a totally different singer to us that, you know, he had to come up with his own melody and lyrics and whatnot.
And is that something, Tony, when you decided that you needed to get a new singer and when Ozzy was let go, was that something that was important to you? Did you want to make sure you got a singer that was very different than Ozzy versus somebody that sounded a lot like him?
I think we had to. And it just fell into place anyway. But, I mean, we didn't. Ronnie was sort of the first choice because I'd met Ronnie at a party beforehand, and I was feeling a bit disgruntled because of all the things that were going on with Sabbath. It was sort of falling apart, and I was talking to Ronnie about sort of even doing a separate project, you know, and Ronnie said, yeah, he'd be interested in that. But of course, when it happened that Ozzy had to leave, then the first choice was Ronnie. I said to the other guys, you know, about Ronnie, and said, well, yeah, let's get him over and have a try with him and just jam around and see what happens. And of course, as soon as he came over and started singing, that was it. But I think if we'd have looked for a singer to sound like Ozzy, I mean, there's only one Ozzy, and Ozzy was Ozzy, and he had his own way, you know. And so to bring somebody in that sounded similar would be, I don't know. I think we went the best way by going totally opposite. And by, of course, bringing Ronnie into the band, it the writing changed. We could write in a different way for Ronnie, because his approach was different to songs than Ozzy was. And Ozzy's stuff was great. I mean, I'm not knocking Ozzy's. Oh, he's really great, the stuff he'd done. But when Ronnie came in, it was another. We went another direction in a way, because it sort of got me to write differently and got us all to play differently, because it was a different sound and we were creating a different sound, and it was exciting. And a good thing about Ronnie as well, it encouraged me to play more. After being obviously with Richie, I suppose he's used to long guitar solos and stuff. So Ronnie right. sort of encouraged me to play, play along a solo. Oh, great, you know. So it was it worked out really well.
Yeah, Geezer mentioned that too. Geezer said that once, because he had written the lyrics up to that point with Sabbath, and he said once Ronnie came and wrote the lyrics, it freed him up to work more on his playing and focus more on just being a bass player as opposed to worrying about lyrics and shaping the songs. I also want to ask you about a song that surfaced very recently, Tony. I'm sure you're aware of this. I know Geezer was the other day, but Jeff Nichols, who had done keyboards around this time for you, his estate posted a song that on YouTube the other day that they said was an outtake from Heaven and Hell called Slapback. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I'm not at all happy with that at all. I mean, it's left a really bad taste in my mouth. At that point, when we did that, Jeff wasn't even involved in the band. I hadn't even got Jeff over at that time. That is actually Ronnie playing bass on that. And that was, so you didn't know that one, did you?
No.
That was Ronnie playing on it. And we played, that was just in the lounge, recorded on a cassette. We had one or two things that we'd jam around on and play on and stuff, but it weren't right for the album, so we didn't put it into shape, we didn't record it or anything.
Did part of it or some of it become Walk Away?
I don't know, really. I actually don't know. It might have materialized into Walk Away, I don't know.
There's somebody online, you know how people get into this stuff, and some music professor guy sent me a link today saying that if you listen to it, that this would have turned into Walk Away, a certain part of it. Because I know Walk Away is an interesting song on Heaven and Hell in that it's not like the other songs on the record. It's a little bit, the whole feel of it is a little brighter, I think, than the rest of the record.
Yeah, I mean, Walk Away wasn't one of my favorite ones, to be fair. And I mean, I love that album, but that Walk Away was good at the time, but
it's different than the rest of the record.
That's what happens with the writing, you know. Sometimes you might do a song and go, no, we won't use that, but there's the one part in it. Let's try that, and we'll use that in the song, and that does happen. So I might well have done. I don't remember doing that, but I might well have done.
Tony, have you had a chance to spend any time with the latest editions of the records? Were you very involved in them, whether it be the mastering or the added live tracks or the stuff on them?
Oh, yeah, I've been involved as far as, you know, that sent me the copies to listen to and see what I thought, and did I like this or do I add this or that. So, yeah, I thought the guys had done a great job anyway, and all the covers and everything. I think they're really, really classy-looking product.
Yeah, they really did do a wonderful job with them. So when it came to Mob Rules, I would imagine that things were very, very different in the sense that there was a feeling that the lineup had been solidified. Vinny had done some touring. Now He had recorded the song Mob Rules. I know you guys had done that earlier at John Lennon's place. Then the record comes around. Ronnie had some already a record and some touring and history under his belt. Maybe the Where's Ozzy factor had worn down at that point because people knew that Ronnie was the guy. Take me through the Mob Rules period for you. I imagine that was a really wonderful part of that lineup.
It was. It was great because we were all used to playing with each other at that point. And it was great for Geezer as well because, you know, where in the past with old, you know, with the old Sabbath, Geezer had to do the lyrics, like you were saying earlier, and the bass playing. And he has to work out some, I mean, he's a great bass player, work out some great stuff. So it freed up a lot of things, really. And the Mob Rules was one we could just go in and we'd jam. And come up with ideas, and Geezer could just concentrate on his bass work, and Vinny on his drums, and me on guitar. And then, of course, that would be it, really. Then,
you know, to me, the song "Sign of the Southern Cross," one of the highlights for me on the Mob Rules. That I always looked at that, and tell me how you feel about it. But I always felt like that was the heaven and hell. I'm talking about the song of the Mob Rules. That huge epic song that heaven and hell the song was to me. Sign of the Southern Cross always occupied that same space on Mob Rules. Did you have that in mind when you wrote it? Was that sort of what you were going for?
It was actually absolutely. I mean, It was another version of it was the heaven and hell of that album. Really, I really liked that, the Sign of the Southern Cross, and I liked it with the space as well, like we did on Heaven and Hell. You know, where Ronnie could sing away in the middle, and then the riff would come in. I really liked that.
And when you talk about songs that maybe are a little different in tone from Sabbath, like we talked about with Walk Away from Heaven and Hell, the one that jumps out to me that I kind of feel that way about on Mob Rules a little bit is Country Girl, only in the sense of lyrically, I don't think it's anything Sabbath would have ever have done without Ronnie. Would you agree? What are your thoughts on Country Girl?
I definitely agree. That was one of the topics that did come up when we were doing it. We went, "You're not going to sing about a country girl, are you?" I mean, it did, and Geezer's going, "Country girl." You know, it was so different for us, and we did that. That was a bit of a dispute we had at the time, but we went along with it in the end. But yeah, because we had this, you know, the heavy riff, and then it's singing about a country girl. I thought, blimey, that's so different for us. I mean, we'd never done anything like that.
Yeah, especially the opening lyric, "Fell in love with a country girl." It's just not something that you would think of being very Sabbathy. But in retrospect, yeah. I mean, the song is great. I mean, it fits fine now. But now, when you think of it in the context of coming off of what Sabbath stood for at the time, you could definitely tell someone else was steering the lyrics at that point.
Absolutely. But again, you see, Ronnie could sing about anything, and the way he put it over would be. You know, it just took you away from into another zone. I mean, it's such a great way of attacking the vocals. You know, you got this real anger, and well, I'm telling you about it. I mean, you know everything about Ronnie. I mean, it's such a great way of presenting songs, and so that sort of took it away from the country girl sort of name, if you like.
Yeah, because, yes, you're absolutely right. In terms of the approach and the tone of it and the way he delivers it, it doesn't feel that way. But then when you step aside from it, you're like, that's not something you would expect Sabbath to have on a record. Yeah. And then when you talk about some of the deeper tracks on the Mob Rules, one of my all-time favorites is actually the final track on the record, Over and Over, which is more of a bluesy thing, but Ronnie's voice, which is one of my favorite vocals he ever did, but you also have some incredibly tasty playing in there. And I thought that was really cool too, at this particular era, that you had the versatility to do stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing. We were open for doing whatever we liked. We had to do what we liked. I mean, we couldn't do it to please other people. And we really enjoyed doing these tracks, and and doing him in the way we felt. And it was great with Over and Over. They wanted me to do a solo on it, a long solo, and I did. And what I liked about that lineup, we pushed each other on. And I'd play a solo and Ronnie'd say, "Oh, I really like that," you know. Or he'd say, "Go on, Tony, you can do a better one than that." And it would sort of, we'd spark each other on, and Geezer as well. So it was all of us, you know, Vin. It was just a different atmosphere again on Mob Rules. It was, it really worked.
What are your recollections about the touring for the record?
I don't know. I can't. I good tour, I should imagine.
But did you remember it being better received than Heaven and Hell? Because with the Heaven and Hell tour, you had to go out and do. With Blue Oyster Cult, Black and Blue. It was a co-headline. My recollection, because I saw the Mob Rules tour, my recollection was it was really when this lineup felt fully locked in and that people knew. I mean, knew what it was. I mean, I saw you guys headline an arena in New Jersey on that tour, so it was a little bit different. It felt like it was another Mob Rules was another step forward in just solidifying what the new version of Sabbath was going to be.
Absolutely. Well, again, as I say, Heaven and Hell, we went out. We had to prove ourselves again. So it was a real introducing Ronnie to the fans and going through ups and downs. You know, some people liking it, some people not. But by the time we got to Mob Rules, people knew what we were about, and it was a lot more relaxing. We were so tight. The band was really tight, And what I also liked about that lineup is we could jam on stage. We'd put things in. We'd add things. It wouldn't have to be exactly the same every night as such. You know, you could say, "Oh, I'll do a longer solo," and everybody'd know where you are and follow you. And Ronnie'd do a lot of ad libs, and it was just different. It wouldn't always be the same.
Well, yeah, and that's evident in the song Heaven and Hell, because when you did that live, and people can hear that in some of the previously unreleased live stuff on these reissues, the song Heaven and Hell would go on its own journey at some points, right? I mean, that really spread out.
Yeah, and sometimes you get to the point, "Oh, blimey, how are we going to get out of this now? We've got to this jam. Where do we go? How do we get out?" But it was exciting, you know. It kept you on the ball, and I think that was it'd get you off. Because you'd be excited about it, and you keep you on edge, and because you never knew where you were going to go. We'd go on stage, and we had confidence with each other. That was the thing, you know. We knew we'd be playing a show, and we knew Ronnie'd be like. We knew what each of us would be like. But when we go into a jam, we never knew where we were going to go, and it could either work or not. And, you know, most times it worked.
And, Tone, I'm curious. These records, these two records, are so incredible and timeless, and I listen to them every day, you know, all the time, like they just came out. And, you know, I'm curious, though, this was a time that was so interesting for Sabbath, what you guys were going through, which we've documented. But then you talk about Ozzy, who at that point, I think a lot of people had essentially left for dead and thought he'd never resurrect anything. And parallel to these two records, he's creating these incredible records with Randy Rhoads and Bob Daisley and Lee Kerslake that are also legendary and iconic with Blizzard of Oz and Diary of a Madman. Were you guys, were you looking at that? Were you watching that and saying, "How the hell is this guy pulling the, like, what, how did this happen?" Because again, even his management didn't expect he'd be able to do something like that.
Well, I mean, I think it was the best thing for us. It was the best thing for all of us, because it made us work again, made us all realize, blimey, you know, we've got to do something here. And it was great because, you know, Sharon got Ozzy on rolling again. I mean, Ozzy went through a real bad dip in himself, and he was managed to be pulled out of it, and they got a good band behind him, and coming up with some good songs, and it was really, really good. He took on a career, as we did. So we took on the career we run, and then Ozzy took on his career as his solo thing, which was really good. So we got, you know, people have got two bands for the price of one, really.
Yeah, really, it was. It really was addition by subtraction when you think of the output of music at that time. And I'm curious, what were your thoughts the first time you heard Randy Rhoads?
Good. Yeah, he's a good player. I mean, I didn't really sort of sit down and study Ozzy's albums at all because I was too concerned with what we were doing. To be fair,
right.
But when I would hear it on the radio, yeah, he's a great player, really great player. But there again, before that, I'd heard Eddie Van Halen, so
right,
great player,
right, right, yeah, that's pretty much.
I mean, but you know, Randy was a young lad and brilliant.
Yeah, for sure. So before I let you go, Tone, give everybody the update on what's next in terms of Sabbath reissues. You know, last time we spoke not too long ago, we were talking a little bit also about the Tony Martin era. You've got the Born Again record, which of course is the record that in the Sabbath trajectory comes after Mob Rules, because we all know Ronnie left and would come back a couple times, and that's a whole nother story. But in terms of the Sabbath lineage, you would get Ian Gillan, you would make Born Again, which a lot of people have new respect for as a record. When you continue to revisit the material, what would you like to do next? I know there's some of the Tony Martin stuff you're dealing with too. So what can fans expect down the line?
Well, I mean, that's the thing is re-looking at this stuff and because a lot of people have wanted out, because in some ways with Tony Martin, you know, he's got pushed in the back, and he was a great singer, and we've done some great stuff with Tony Martin, I think. And, so we will launch some of that once we get to that point. Obviously, the Ronnie stuff's out now. So, and the Ian Gillan situation, well, that's unfortunate, because people are going, oh, why don't you remix the album? We can't, because we don't have the tape. We've lost, and I don't know how, but the tapes have got lost. I think we have about three tapes of Born Again, and for somewhere or other, the others have gone missing, and we don't know where they are. So it's really frustrating, because you can't, you know, you need to tell the fans, look, we can't remix it. We haven't got the tapes and redo it. So we can only do what we can do and remaster it and stuff. But it would have been nice to have been able to get those again and look at them. But, I mean, who knows? One day they might turn up wherever they may be. I don't know. We seem to have lost it in that Don Arden period. So they could be stored anywhere and somebody could have them. I don't know. Maybe somebody will release them on blooming on the internet at some point.
isn't that how you find out where everything is? Somebody pops up out of nowhere with something?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God, that one surfaced. But that's the plan, is to do... you know, go through the periods of the different forms of Sabbath, and then maybe go into my solo stuff.
Mm. Yeah, I love the Fused record that you did with Glenn. I mean, there's so much good stuff there. And the last thing, when you talk about this and when you hear these songs, I mean, the natural feeling from a rock fan like myself is, my gosh, it would be so great to hear these performed, or some of this material performed live. Now, we all know, tragically, Ronnie's no longer with us. And you, as the constant in Sabbath from day one till now, the guy who's been a part of all of this material, is there a, you know, just wishful thinking as a fan, it would be amazing to me to be able to see you put a group together and go up there and play a cross-section of material, be able to have, whether they be the singers themselves or people, one singer come up and do Headless Cross and do maybe No Stranger to Love and then do stuff from Dio and then maybe even some of the Ozzy stuff. Would you like that? I know you can't really tour right now, but is that something that you would enjoy doing, to, if you could find a way to basically play your history in some way live once again?
Well, yeah, maybe. I mean, it's, you know, I'd have liked to have done another so many gigs with Sabbath again, you know, with the original lineup. But of course, you know, taking on a tour again, it's really difficult because you've either got to sign up for, you know, 12 months or 18 months because it's a big show, it's become a big show. And once you get to that stage, you've just got to go on and it does you in at the end of the 18 months. But to go out and do a few shows, yeah, I'd like to do that. And I mean, I love playing. I love seeing the audience. I love playing to the audience. But I'd have to go out and have a good band. I couldn't just go out and just... That's why I don't get up and jam with people. I never do that because I never feel confident enough to get up and jam with people unless I can rehearse with them first and make sure I know what it's all about, really, you know.
Considering Ozzy's health, would you, if he was healthy enough to do it, and we certainly all hope that he does get well, you don't rule out at some point with the original band not touring but possibly doing a scattered show here or there?
Yeah, I don't rule out anything at the moment, Eddie. I'm quite open. And it's great because I've had the time to, in this period, to sort of enjoy everything. One of my main problems with touring all the time was I had no home life, and none of us did, really. So for me, I wanted to have my home life. I see my daughter and my wife and family and everybody. So now I'm getting that chance. Well, I'm sort of getting the chance. And since the pandemic came, of course, it stopped to seeing my daughter and things. You couldn't unless you're in a bubble. But yeah, I mean, I do miss playing. I miss playing live. I mean, I can play all the time here at home, but it's nothing like a live show. It's nothing like that stimulation. We've had some great players, you know. Playing with Vinny was great. Playing with Bill, playing with Geese and everybody. It's been a great period. You know, it's had its ups and downs over the years, but you can't take it away. You know, I've stuck with it and I enjoyed it. You know,
I'm laughing because so many of the musicians I talk to who have complained about never being home for so long, it's now going the other way. It's like, I got to get out of the house. Whether it's their girlfriend or their wife or their kids or someone driving them crazy, they're ready to take a gig playing anywhere, Tone.
I mean, I must say, I do. I like being at home, and I keep myself busy. You know, I'm taking another, like most people do at the time. I go out for walks in the morning and with my wife, and we do different things, but it's at home.
Right.
So it does get a bit sort of monotonous. You want to go out and see your friends, and I will be doing some of these. I was doing before the pandemic. I was doing these evening with Tony Iommi, and I was going doing these shows where I do a talk about the history of my history and Sabbath and all the rest of the stuff I've done. I was doing those sort of things, and I had quite a few of those booked in, like in Germany and Italy and Finland and Sweden. And of course, they all had to get cancelled when the pandemic happened. But I quite enjoyed doing those because that, again, was a contact for me with the fans. And it was being on stage talking about your life, really. And I probably will do some more of those once things happen, as well as playing.
Tone, I just got an idea, and I'll let you go on this. You can think about it. So I just bought a place in Las Vegas, just a little getaway home, because I love Las Vegas. I see somewhere in neon right now, a Tony Iommi residency interview series hosted by Eddie Trunk. Me and you on a couple bar stools on the Vegas Strip. What do you think?
I'd be up for that. Absolutely.
Tony Iommi storytellers will take questions from the audience. I'm serious. I think it'll be amazing.
I know. You're the man. You're the man. You know everything about my life and the history of Sabbath. You know everything. And you've been that close to it. You've been an extra member, you have. I mean, you know the life of it. You do. And it's great because that's the sort of thing you need. You need somebody that knows about it to ask you the questions, or the audience ask you the questions, or whatever. Yes, I actually, yes. Yeah,
I'm going to pitch it to Ralph. Maybe it's something after the pandemic we can do, because I know some producers that would love to do that. I think it would be awesome. People would get a kick out. But you know the problem, Tony, you and I would get talking and it would be like a 4-hour show. I do an hour. I do an hour on Forbidden Alone.
I'd be up for that, Eddie. Absolutely.
We could do a week on Seventh Star and it would be like, forget about it. Well, who knows? Let's get through this. Let's get through this damn madness of this world right now. And maybe it's something somewhere down the line we could do. I think it would be a lot of fun. But I appreciate the time, as always. I really do. And I wish you well and stay healthy. And hopefully we'll get to see each other soon.
All right, my friend. Eddie, before you go, thanks for your birthday text. That was fantastic. Thank you very much.
Well, a very happy birthday to you and many more.
Thank you. And all the audience out there that did send stuff to my Facebook and Twitter and whatever, that's great. Thank you.
Tone, take care of yourself. Thank you for the time. Anything you need, you know where to get me.
Thanks, Eddie. All the best, mate.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, mate. Bye-bye.
Well, I can't thank Tony enough, and we are going to work on doing a Vegas show together for real. As crazy as that sounds, the Tony and Eddie show could be coming to the Strip soon. I bought a place in Vegas that I'll be getting in June, and who knows? Who knows what's going to happen once I get out there a little bit? All right, we will be right back. Interview number two, another founding member of Sabbath, Geezer Butler. Legendary stuff from Geeze coming up next.
Hey, movie lovers, who needs a theater when you have Pluto TV? Grab your popcorn and your streaming device because free movies are here. Pluto TV is your home for movies. Great movies are playing anytime in over 20 exclusive movie channels of action, horror, rom-coms, and more. Watch hits like Saving Private Ryan, Pretty in Pink, and Charlie's Angels all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts. Ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.
This is Denny Somach, host of The Rock Podcast. I'm a producer, author, and rock historian, and I want to share with you some of the greatest stories in rock and roll.
Well, Bonzo was the best hard rock drummer ever, hands down. I mean, no one comes within a mile of him.
I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. John Lennon had this wise guy look on his face, just like me and my friends were just a bunch of wise guys, street kids.
The first guitar I ever had was Spanish guitar, and I couldn't really get the hang of it. I was only 13.
I had never written a song before, actually, and so Jim says, okay, everybody go home and write some songs, you know. And so I went home and wrote Light My Fire.
Join me for The Rock Podcast, the only podcast that matters, from Podcast One or wherever you get yours.
We're back, and it's now time for one of the great bass players of all time and another founding member of Black Sabbath, Geezer Butler. Enjoy. Geez.
Hello, Eddie. Hello, Eddie.
How are you, man? How you been holding up?
I'm thinking of starting my own bowling career.
Have you been practicing at all, Geezer?
Yeah, practicing lying in bed.
Well, I'll tell you, I miss our bowling events. I miss all the events. Of course, it's been a crazy year. How have you been? Have you been in LA the whole time during the lockdown?
LA and Utah. I got a house up in the mountains in Utah, so I spend quite some time there.
Have you been working on music or doing anything during the downtime?
At the moment, I'm working on a memoir.
How far along are you?
Written about 10 pages. It's taken me 2 months to do 10 pages.
So we're looking at maybe a 2030 release, Geez?
Yeah, could be, yeah.
Well, I look forward to it whenever you get around to it. It's hard finding the discipline to do it, right? That was my problem when I wrote my books, is you need to adhere to deadlines. If you don't have somebody giving you a deadline, it's easy to just say, nah, I'll do it another time. That was my problem.
Exactly. Yeah, you sit down to write, and then like somebody calls you or something, invites you out to dinner or something. Then it takes you like another 3 or 4 days to get into the spirit of writing it again. So it's really, you just have to lock yourself away and have absolutely nobody to interrupt you.
When are you going to start? Is it going to be your life story from being a kid forward, or is it going to be just starting around the time of Sabbath? What's your timeline on it?
No, it's about growing up in Aston, in Birmingham, and on from there.
Okay, so it'll start early on.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm excited for it. I look forward to it coming out. So obviously, Geezer, here we are again, revisiting and remembering this great period of Sabbath from Heaven and Hell and the Mob Rules and the Dio era of the band, as you well know, an era that's really, really special to me. And over the last 15 years or so, we've all done, you know, I've done a lot with you guys about it. It's hard to believe these records, 40 and 41 years old now. What are your recollections about this whole period? Because I know, starting with Heaven and Hell, it was a rough period for you where you were almost not part of that. So give everybody your remembrances about this particular period of time for Sabbath.
Well, we started off, with Ozzy in the band, and we hired a house in Bel Air in Los Angeles, and we were doing, Tony and me and Bill were coming up with a lot of music, and Ozzy just didn't seem to be into anything that we were coming up with, and eventually Ozzy left the band, and it was either call it a daytime, or Tony said that he'd met this guy called Ronnie James Dio, who'd sang with Ritchie Blackmore and Rainbow, and what about, you know, inviting him up and see if he could do anything with the music that we'd written so far. And Ronnie came up, and he was really, really enthusiastic, which is what we all needed, because we thought, you know, it's going to be the end of the band. Ronnie came in, sang to the three music ideas that we had. I think the first one was Children of the Grave, and it sounded great from then on.
Children of the Sea, I think, right? Geese, Children of the Sea.
Yeah, Children of the Sea.
Yeah, not Children of the Grave, different era. You said Children of the Grave.
Oh, God.
Also a great song, but obviously that would, you know, create a timeline issue. That's what I was checking.
Well, yes. Children of the Sea, and I think Walk Away or something like that, and some other thing. And then I had to leave the band because I was having divorce problems back in England. So I left for a while. Meanwhile, they'd written the song Heaven and Hell and Die Young. And I came back and I heard Heaven and Hell and Die Young for the first time as a fan would hear it. And I was just absolutely blown away with it. And the rest is history, as they say.
Now, when you left to go back to England to deal with that issue at the time, was it always the intent that you would return, or was it a question mark whether you would return to the band?
It was a question mark. I was just in such a bad way at the time, going through divorce, because I'd been with my wife since school days. And Ozzy leaving and then divorce, it was just like killing me. And I just had to get away and deal with my issues and just clear my head. And once I got that, I saw things in a totally different light. And I'd been in touch with Tony and Bill all the time, every day since I'd left, because they wanted to know how I was doing, because they were worried about me, about the divorce. And eventually I felt great once I got everything out of the way. And then Tony says, you know, we want you back. Come back if you up to it. And I came back, and it was great.
What when you came back and rejoined, where were they in the process for the record? Had everything else been written? Had they started recording anything? Were they working with another bass player in the event you didn't come back?
Everything was recorded except Neon Nights, that had yet to be written. And I came back, and I already knew like three of the songs anyway that were written before I'd left. And so there was just Heaven and Hell and Die Young that I hadn't really had any part of. And I just listened to them without any bass on and then put my own bass to them all. And then we wrote Neon Nights in Paris.
So was the so when you say everything was recorded, they actually recorded everything but the bass at that point, or somebody else laid a bass track down and then you replaced it?
Somebody else had put the bass track down, but when I heard it, that kept the bass off. So you know, everything I'd play would be what I'd do, and we went from there. And Martin Birch, the producer, really, really helped a lot as well.
Well, Martin, a legendary producer, Deep Purple, Iron Maiden, so many amazing things. Sadly, he passed away last year. But I was wondering about that, too, because Sabbath had never worked with him before. And his work with Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules is, I think, brilliant. His records always sound incredible. And the last few Sabbath records before Heaven and Hell, if I'm not mistaken, the band themselves, you guys produced them. So what was it like working? Not only are you working with a new singer in Ronnie James Dio, but you're working with a new producer for the first time who you hadn't worked with and given somebody else the reins. How was that whole experience?
We desperately needed a producer. You know, it's no good trying to do stuff on your own when there's like four people saying, well, this should be loud and that should be loud and whatever. Having a producer it gave us a chance to go in on your own. You didn't have to have the whole band there. You could just go in with the producer and work with just the two of you and bounce ideas off each other like that. And I think that's why those two albums, Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules, stand up today, because the production's so great.
You know, it's also really, when you think about it in retrospect, it's super important that you ended up coming back in and doing Heaven and Hell. Not only because your playing is brilliant on it and it's a brilliant record, but also because at that time, I would think for Tony and Bill at that time, to market Sabbath with not only one, but then two new members, if you hadn't come back, potentially a new bass player, would have made it even more challenging. It was going to be challenging to market, I would think, a band without the singer, a new singer at that point. But if you hadn't come back, then they're looking at the prospect of trying to get fans to buy into a band that was half of the band they once knew. I think that at that time, for that first record, that would have been difficult.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think I had total new enthusiasm for the band, because towards the end of the Aussie era, everybody was like really low, and we were in a bad place. The record company was sort of forgot about us. They weren't behind us anymore. And we just needed a kick up the rump, and which is what we got when Ronnie came in. And it felt like a whole new band when I came back. You could just feel the enthusiasm with everyone, and it just worked.
And where were you when you came back into the band to record Heaven and Hell? Bill is still there. Bill would do the first few weeks of the tour for the Heaven and Hell record. But what were you sensing with Bill? Did you have any insights or feeling that you may lose Bill during that tour? Did you get a feeling that he maybe had one foot out the door while you were making the record with him?
No, not at all. I mean, I knew that Bill was really upset about, you know, Ozzy's departure, as we all were. You know, it's like losing one of your brothers, because we'd all virtually grown up together. We were all from the same part of Birmingham in Aston. And it really was like losing your brother. I think it hit Bill harder than anyone else in the band, and his drinking just got worse and worse and worse. And when we went on tour, he just used to get booze all the time. And this one night, he was sitting outside his hotel drinking, and we all went to bed, got up the next day, like about 10 o'clock in the morning. Bill was still in the same position outside his hotel room, still boozing. And soon after that, he just got on his bus and left the tour without telling anybody.
Mm. Do you have, before you move on to Mob Rules and Vinny coming in, do you have a favorite track on Heaven and Hell? Is there one or two tracks that for you personally are great memories or just favorite songs?
I love playing Heaven and Hell. It's a great song to play live because it is, you could extend it for as long as you wanted to do and have a really good jam on it when we were doing it live. I think Children of the Sea, one of my favorites.
Do you have a least favorite? Do you have one you don't like?
Probably Walk Away.
Yeah, I bring that up because I read an interview with Tony recently, and he called that one out too. It's kind of a different. It's almost a happy song for Sabbath, even though the story, the subject isn't just the sound of it. It's kind of a. I'm not a musician, so I don't know how to talk about tunings or what have you. But it just seems like a totally different, almost a poppy approach for Sabbath.
Yeah, it's like a generic rock song.
Yeah. Yeah, it's still a great song, but in the context of the record, but it's just a different tone to the record.
But if it's the rest of the album had sounded like that, then you'd never have heard of us again.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting is, you know, Tony bringing up Ronnie coming in at that time, there was no interest in it. It wasn't about, well, let's go try to find a guy that sounded like Ozzy. I mean, you found Ronnie does not in any way sound like Ozzy vocally. So there was there consideration to that when that decision was being made? I imagine you viewed it as a positive, like, no, this is going to be its own thing. We're going to get a guy that's going to put his own stamp on this stuff as opposed to being a guy that vocally tries to impersonate, you know, who was just in the band.
Well, when he came in, because it was like Children of the Sea, the first thing that we did, his voice was perfect for that song. And Ozzy did a version of it, and it just didn't sound right with Ozzy singing it. When Ronnie sang on it, it was like, yeah, that's what we need. You know, that kind of a voice, that kind of approach. So it was positive from day one, really.
Does anybody have a recording of Ozzy singing Children of the Sea?
I think Ozzy might. I'm sure Tony has. He's got millions of cassettes with stuff on.
I'm going to talk to Tony on Thursday. If he did, I would, that would have been an amazing inclusion to hear that as part of these reissues, which of course are now out now with a bunch of bonus content. And the bonus content, Geezer, on Heaven and Hell includes, there's some previously unreleased live stuff on here. There's a show from Hartford, Connecticut. And then there's part of that show from Hammersmith Odeon from 82. The bonus content on the Heaven and Hell reissue, what can you tell us about that?
Absolutely nothing. I haven't even heard it.
Oh, Geez, I love you. All right. And you know what? I can't tell you, my audience, how many times I've heard that from artists about their own records. I have no idea. So, all right, we'll move on from that.
I've been stuck in Utah for the last 2.5 months. And I think that was when they were sending the copies out. So I haven't really listened to them.
I was going to say, what, they don't have mail in Utah?
No.
FedEx doesn't go there?
Not at all.
Let me ask you about the Mob Rules moving forward. So when you go to make that record, now you're fully in. You had done the tour. There was none of that, no issue going into it. So for you, you were right there from the beginning involved, I'm sure, in all of the writing. So I imagine for you, that was even a more fulfilling experience because now everyone had been used to working with Ronnie. Talk about creating the Mob Rules.
Well, we'd done the album Heaven and Hell was a massive success. The tour was going great, and we were playing actually London Hammersmith, and we got the call that they were making a film of the heavy metal magazine, and they wanted us to do one of the tracks for the soundtrack. So they sent us the storyline and drawings of the part of the film that they wanted us to make. And we went into John Lennon's house. He had a little studio in his house. And we came up with the song, The Mob Rules. And it was written like, it almost wrote itself. It was like done in 2 or 3 days. We finished the written and recorded it and sent it off to heavy metal people. And they put it on the soundtrack. So we got that started and finished the Heaven and Hell tour, went to LA and started writing the Mob Rules album.
The recording more comfortable considering everybody had had some time together at that point, I would imagine. Of course, now two new guys in Sabbath, because then Vinny's in the band and Vinny's recording with you. As a bass player, having a different guy playing drums for the first time really in your career at that point, with Bill not being there and recording with a different drummer, how was that for you?
It was great for me because I was relieved of having to write the lyrics, so I could concentrate on bass for once. And yeah, I thought me and Vinny played really well together. It was a good rhythm section. And Vinny, as you know, is a good bloke anyway. He fitted in straight away. No problem.
And that's another really important thing for people to remember, which I actually forgot for half a second. A huge turning point for you with this era of Sabbath was, yeah, you wrote the lyrics on all the Black Sabbath records and songs leading up to this. So you welcomed that when Ronnie came in and said he was a lyricist and was going to write his lyrics? You were good with that?
Oh, absolutely. Because when we did the Never Say Die album, the original Sabbath, doing the lyrics is like pulling teeth. I mean, I used to do some lyrics and give them to Ozzy, and he wouldn't even read them. He was like totally disinterested. And I just hated writing lyrics by that time. And so it was such a relief when Ronnie came in and somebody that could write interesting lyrics as well. It was a godsend.
The piece before The Mob Rules, that instrumental piece, E5150, is that something you came up with?
Yeah, I used bass pedals for it. I mean, a bass guitar with bass guitar pedals. I came up with that, and then Tony added some guitar bits to it. And I think Jeff Nichols on keyboards added a little bit at the end.
And that piece is on in front of the song The Mob Rules on the album The Mob Rules, but for the heavy metal soundtrack, that piece of music is actually used in the film itself, right?
Is it? I can't remember.
Yeah, I believe it is. I believe it's in the film itself at some point as like a production piece. And then, of course, it showed up as the intro piece. And I'm trying to remember, because the first time I would have seen Sabbath, I'm pretty sure, was the Mob Rules tour. And did they not play that over the PA as you guys took the stage?
Yeah, that was the intro to the whole show.
Yeah. Yeah, I do recall that being a pretty big moment in terms of the setup of the show. What do you recall, Geezer, about the Mob Rules tour?
Not a lot, to be honest. I remember doing the album and then going straight out back on tour. So it was just going through the usual merry-go-round.
Ronnie had often told me over the years that when he first came out and you guys did the Heaven and Hell tour, and it was the tour with the Black and Blue tour with Blue Oyster Cult, he had told me that there were members in the audience at that time. There were fans that gave him a hard time and gave you guys a hard time about Ozzy not being there, that it took a while. Did you feel that shift on the Mob Rules? Did you feel there was more acceptance towards Ronnie and that went away with the audience?
Oh, absolutely. I think people started accepting Ronnie after like the first week of the Heaven and Hell tour, because, you know, they'd heard the album by then and heard by word of mouth how good the show was with Ronnie. And they sort of accepted him almost straight away.
And I don't know if you know this, but like over the weekend, you mentioned Jeff Nichols a couple times, who played keyboards on these records, that over the weekend, Jeff Nichols' estate or whoever runs his social media put out a previously, what they call a previously unreleased song from the Dio Sabbath era called Slapback. Have you heard of that? Do you have any knowledge of that?
Yeah, that was one of the songs that we did before I left. It's probably the reason why I did leave. no, it was just one of those, you know, songs that didn't make the grade.
So are you on it? You played on it before? That was before you left to go back to England?
Yeah, that was right before I left. Yeah, it was just a one-off thing. We just jammed it and didn't think anything more of it. Didn't really work.
Was Jeff Nichols going to be was he the guy who played bass in your absence?
Yeah.
Interesting. It's interesting he has an unreleased song, but these two records on Rhino with bonus content from the label doesn't have it.
Oh, no, it's incredible, and it's quite good quality as well. I've heard
right.
the two songs that from the Jeff Nichols thing, and it's reasonable quality.
And we might be talking in a few years about yet another reissue of these records, Geezer. This is like the fourth one.
I'm sure you will. long after I'm not here anymore.
No, you're not going anywhere, man. You got to finish that book. It's going to take you at least 10 years, so you're good. Hey, one or two quick things, and then I'll let you go. Something that I read in the liner notes to these reissues that I was floored by, and I think this is, in the world of heavy music, this is explosive news. But you maintain that the whole, for lack of a better term, metal sign, devil horns, whatever, that Ronnie is credited for starting, that you actually had been doing it before and you put the idea in his head to do it. You got to talk about that.
Absolutely. I've been doing that sign since, I've got pictures of me doing it since 1971. And I always used to do it in the breakdown in the song Black Sabbath, just before it goes into the fast part at the end, I'd do that sign to the audience. And on the first couple of Heaven and Hell tour shows, Ronnie was saying, when I'm going on stage, everybody's doing the peace sign to me, and that's an Aussie thing. And I feel like I should be doing something back to him. And I showed him, he says, what's that sign that you do in Black Sabbath? And I showed him the devil horn sign. And he started doing it from there and made it famous.
So you realize that the significance of that has been out there and hugely debated as to where it started. Gene Simmons has taken some claim to it from, you know, saying he did it in 76 or whatever. Until these reissues came out and I got my copies the other day, I've never heard you talk about this, that this originated with you. How come did you ever say this publicly before?
I didn't really think much of it because, you know, I was doing it, as I say, I got pictures of me doing it in 1971, and it was just an alternative to Aussie's peace signs. I was doing it. And if you look at the Yellow Submarine album cover, John Lennon's cartoon character's doing it in 1966 or whatever it was. So, you know, it's an old sign. I was just doing it because that Aleister Crowley used to do it.
Yeah, well, Ronnie's story about doing it, and I'm Italian myself, so I related to what Ronnie used to say, which was that it was
grandma did it.
Yeah, well, it is in Italian folklore. It is a sign. It's called the Maloica. That is a real thing, and it's something to ward off evil spirits. And Ronnie, being Italian, he and I would talk about that all the time. But he never used to say that you put it in his head to do it.
I know there's a lot of things that Ronnie, he nicked off me, that he claimed that he was the originator. But, you know, he made it famous, so.
Well, give me one other thing that he nicked off of you.
His album title, Sacred Heart. That's where I used to go to school.
And he is that right?
One of his songs, One Foot in the Grave, and I jokingly said we should call the album One Foot in the Grave. And then when he left the band, he called one of his songs that.
Interesting.
He was very naughty about things like that. And I used to sign, when I did an autograph, I'd write Magic. And so Ronnie started writing Magic as well. In fact, he called his album Magica.
Right, right.
He was very naughty about things like that.
Did you ever confront him about it?
No. Only about the devil horn sign.
Yeah, because Gene Simmons tried to copyright that and lost that copyright, but you could have went after him for it if you had proof that you started it earlier.
Yeah, I've got photographs of me doing it.
Wow, that I never knew that, Geez. I never knew that. And if you can clear up what exactly went on. Now, the record that came out as a live record of these two albums was the Live Evil record. And there's been so much talk about that. People deny it, confirm it, that Ronnie would go in and change things. You and Tony changed things, and that led to the breakup the first time around of that version of the band. Is that exactly what happened? Is that the truth? Is that what was at the core of all of it?
That's what was according to the engineer that was doing the engineering the live album. And plus, Ronnie was concentrating on his solo album by then. And I think Tony sort of took offense that Ronnie had gone out and got himself a solo album instead of like concentrating on Sabbath. So it all came down to that.
The other really interesting thing about this period is here's Sabbath reborn with a new singer, widely loved records with Heaven and Hell and The Mob Rules, and then your singer, your former singer, Ozzy Osbourne, which people had written off and thought would never do anything ever again, also, amazingly, at the same time, puts out two brilliant records with an incredible guitar player with Randy Rhoads and Bob Daisley and Lee Kerslake, this incredible band. How closely were you guys watching what he was doing, and what were your thoughts about? Were you shocked that he was able to create something like that with those people?
No, I mean, Ozzy had already left the band before the Never Say Die album, and he was always going on about doing his own thing back then. In fact, in one of the Sabbath photos, he's got a Blizzard of Oz t-shirt on. So I knew he wanted. He just fell out of love with what we were doing in Sabbath, and I wasn't really paying much attention to what he was doing, to be honest. And then he came out, you know, and he was probably bigger than Sabbath ever was.
Well, of course, you would end up going to play in his band for a little bit, not too long after that.
Maintain friendship.
So there wasn't a competitiveness, there wasn't a rivalry, there wasn't looking at chart positions around the world and saying, you know, we got him here or he's got us there. It was none of that?
No, we all loved Ozzy. We were so glad that he got himself, because he was killing himself at the state that he was in when he left Sabbath. He really was on the verge. And if it wasn't for Sharon, I think he'd have topped himself eventually. He'd never, you know, he'd have OD'd or something, and she pulled him out of it, got him straight again.
Well, it's an incredible period. It's the period that I was first introduced to Sabbath. It's super special to me. I love that we're revisiting it again. I could talk about it forever. I love these records. I also think Dehumanizer is a very, very underrated record. For me, I really got into Dehumanizer when you guys came back together in 06 and started playing stuff from it live. I think that because of the time that record came out, it was probably a bit overlooked. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah, because it was all the Seattle sound back then, wasn't it, that was really popular.
Mm. Yeah, and of course, the final record, The Devil You Know, made under the name Heaven and Hell, your thoughts about that as a final testament to this era of the band?
That was the most fun record to make of all of them, because we were all heavily involved in the writing of it. And we wrote it all at Ronnie's studio at his house, and we had a really, really good time making it. We'd all grown up, and all the egos had gone out the window, and all that kind of stuff, all that was in the past. And we all really enjoyed each other's company, and had a really good fun time writing and doing the writing, and then the album is great.
Yeah, it really is. It's all four of the studio records I absolutely love, and I know that towards the end of Ronnie's life that you and he were very close, and I think it's great that you come out and do the charity stuff with us, and I hope you're polishing up the bowling ball. Hopefully we'll be able to bowl again soon.
Yeah.
Come on, Geezy, you got your own shoes. I was telling everybody, man, you were good to go. You were good. You turned in two tremendous performances on the lanes with me.
Yeah, one good performance.
Did you get the shot? Are you good? Are you ready to hit the road again when things open up?
I've got both vaccinations done, and I'm really looking forward to be able to go back to England because I haven't been there since December 2019. So my house over there has probably fell down by now. So I'm hoping to go back to England in May.
And last thing, in addition to this book, whenever you get around to finishing it, musically, are you working on anything? I hear Deadland Ritual may be a dead issue. Where do things stand with that? And do you want to play still and do a band, or would you ever want to play with Tony again in some configuration? What are you thinking as far as playing?
I'm just concentrating on this book for now. I mean, I still play, write riffs and stuff. You know, it's part of my life. But nothing definite. Yeah, Deadland Ritual's dead. So I've got so many ideas and stuff written. I just got to find the time to sit down and go through them all.
And what caused Deadland Ritual to be dead? Just trying to keep it together, the difficulty trying to start something brand new like that? What happened there?
The virus put the final nail in the coffin. Because, I mean, we had 12 or 13 songs written. We were about to go into the studio in last March, and everything closed down. Matt left the band, and Steve's got a lung condition or something, so he couldn't leave the house because of the virus, and it just it just didn't revive it.
So it's not something.
You never know; he might do it in next year or something. I don't know.
Right. Well, look, it's always great to talk to you, Geezer. I appreciate the time. I hope I get a chance to see you soon. I'm glad you're all vaccinated, and hopefully you can get back to England and check on your place there. And my best to your wife and your family. And hopefully hopefully the Dio events are able to happen this year, and we get to roll the bowling ball a little bit together again.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, be great.
All right, my friend. Take care of yourself, all right?
Okay, good speaking with you.
See you, all right, Geezer. Okay, take care, man. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, thanks to Geese. Hope you enjoyed that interview. Thanks earlier to Tony Iommi. Man, what a week to have Geezer Butler and Tony Iommi on a podcast together. Again, those interviews were done a couple days apart, but as part of my Sabbath week on Sirius XM Radio, look, if that doesn't convince you to get on board with me every day on volume on Sirius XM, I don't know what would. We had a different guest every day of the week related to Black Sabbath a couple weeks ago. And the Sabbath reissues of Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules, really, really good. I mean, they're tremendous records to begin with, but the packaging, the audio, the bonus stuff is just great. So thanks to Tony, thanks to Geezer. Next week, the drummers of Black Sabbath, Bill Ward and Vinny Appice. You don't want to miss that either. Remember, follow me on social media for all the updates, especially Twitter and Instagram, at Eddie Trunk. I am on Cameo as well if you're interested in a personalized video. Just search my name at cameo.com. Thanks to Katie Irizarry, the producer of the Eddie Trunk podcast. Thank you for listening. I'll see you guys next Thursday.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.